I'd like to welcome the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Welcome, everyone. We are going to carry over House Bill 2939 and carry over House Bill 2299. And we're going to do a short work session on 3298 before we get into our informational hearing on graduation. So let me open up a work session on House Bill 3298, just to refresh our memory.
Certainly. 3298 provides that the governing body of a county is the district boundary board for purposes of school boundary changes and mergers of school districts.
Okay. We're in a work session. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3298 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 3298 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there were a lot of interesting issues raised in the discussion that we had about this bill, and I hope those get resolved at some point soon. But I'm going to support the bill out of respect for the chair and for the proponents, but I know that there are some issues that still need to be resolved, and I wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Bonamici. We have, this may be an interesting project to do for us between now and February, but I'd like to move this bill just the way it is, and we're voting yes, but I hope we continue to take this work up.
Okay. No other discussion. Do I see any objections? Do I hear any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. House Bill 3298 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator George will be the carrier. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 3298. We have a committee, some esteemed speakers here to look at, I think, the most vexing issue in our schools today, an abysmal graduation rate. And some people are doing better than others, and but this is a state problem, as far as I'm concerned. And so let's just, unless you have something to proceed with, Linda?
I just have a quick summary about graduation.
Please.
Just as a quick summary, graduation rates are a fundamental indicator of whether or not the state's public school system is doing what it intended to do: enroll, engage, and educate youth to be productive members of society. Since almost 90% of the fastest growing and highest paying jobs require some post-secondary education, having a high school diploma and the skills to succeed in college and the workplace are essential. Yet statewide, the reports show that one-third of the students leave high school without a diploma at a high cost to themselves and society at large. And unacceptable low graduation rates, particularly among poor and minority students, have been obscured by unavailable data, calculations, and reporting and inadequate accounting. So today we're going to hear from the Department of Education, university experts, and high school superintendent, and they will help us understand the problem and how to move forward developing solutions.
Thank you. Superintendent Castillo, and why don't we call up Tony Albert at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. I really, really appreciate the opportunity for us to talk about this very critical issue to our state. You are absolutely right in how you set up this conversation. We are not where we need to be as a state on our graduation rates. The news is not good. We have a 66% statewide average graduation rate, and as you said earlier, we have some examples of schools, high school districts that are have a much higher rate than that, and we have some that are below that. The good news I want to address for you today is we have better data than we have ever had before, because we've been building a system, thanks to the investments of the legislature in our data systems, where we now have very accurate information about what is happening to kids as they move through high school from their freshman year to their senior year. And I would say that this has been a national national effort. States across the country have been working on building their data systems so that we as a country could have better data on how we track what happens to our children as they move through high school, so that we can use this data to make better decisions about how we meet the diverse needs of our kids and have a deeper understanding of what is happening to them if they don't graduate. So I know we have a wonderful opportunity on the agenda. You're going to be hearing from the superintendent of the Tigard-Tualatin School District, who does have a much higher graduation rate than the average rate in that district, and they are doing some phenomenal work, systemic work, to make that happen. And I know you're going to have an opportunity to hear about that, because as we talk about the problem, we also today want to present you with solutions and some great work that's happening. So I want to turn now to Tony Alpert, who's going to walk you through the graduation rate, cohort graduation rate, what it is, and how we do the calculations for it.
Thank you, Superintendent. Chair Haas and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present to you information about Oregon's graduation rates. Unfortunately, well, or fortunately, whenever we talk about something as complex as groups of kids or groups of human beings and what happens to them over the course of 4 years, it can get really technical. And so we'll try to keep this at a high level, as high a level as possible. So some of the details, we're not going to get into too deeply unless you ask questions, but we'll try and give you an overview of the graduation rate and how it's calculated. So first I wanted to give you a blanket overview of the system as a whole. And typically, when we have assessment and data collections and information services together, those are principally used as our system metrics for accountability. And so when we combine those two very disparate elements, or they appear to be disparate, we get some surprising opportunities. And as the superintendent mentioned, based on the legislators' investments early on in Oregon's infrastructure and data systems, we are much better prepared to produce this more precise cohort graduation rate than we would have otherwise been. And so the reason for that is, if you look at the first box on the left, which is student identifier. So when we're talking about precisely tracking students, we have to know who's enrolled in the system and where they enrolled and when they enrolled. And so a secure student identifier is particularly important in that regard. The legislature, when it invested in Oregon's online education, online assessment system way back in early 1999 and 2000, that was the initial that created the student identifiers, which are now used throughout our data collection system. So just mostly a reminder to you that when we think about pulling apart aspects of a system that have been built over a decade, there could be unforeseen consequences. And when we put a system together, there could be unforeseen benefits in the future. Some other critical elements are the demographics of students, race, ethnicity, whether or not they're economically disadvantaged, because it's important to disaggregate the information, as you heard the just previously, that the cohort rates are different depending on the demographic profile of students. And then we also want to look at the programs that those students are participating in, whether or not they're participating as a student with a disability or whether or not they're a limited English proficient. We want to look at the enrollment. We want to find out where they were at and how long they were at individual high schools. And then finally, we want to look at how they completed high school, whether or not it was with a GED or a regular diploma or a modified diploma. We want to find out if they completely disengaged or dropped out. And then we want to know whether or not they legitimately transferred out of the system into a private school or to another state. So you can imagine that this is all happening among 120,000 kids statewide who are in high school, 40,000 in each grade, 350 high schools are contributing to this data. This is all being collected over the course of the year at the local level and being submitted to the state level, and it then is validated and finally goes into producing this graduation rate. So it's an incredibly complex system.
Yes, quick question. I don't know how you would keep track of that. If a student moves to California, say, and you lose track, is that counted as a transfer and not a dropout? What if they go to California and don't ever return to school?
It's an excellent question. So if students legitimately transfer to a high school in California, and the school is able to document that, then that would be a transfer out, and the school is not penalized for that. But if a student leaves high school and their status is unaccounted for, then it would reduce their graduation rate.
Makes it kind of tough to follow.
It's an incredibly hard, it's a high standard to track kids when they leave. Right. Keeping track of kids while they're in high school is a difficult enough challenge. Keeping track of kids in homes is probably a significant challenge as well. But in a school, it's an even greater challenge. And then to put the burden on them to track what happens to them if they don't show up at school is a significant burden. But when we want to hold the system accountable for all students eventually receiving a high-quality education and graduating with a diploma, then we have to have some method of making that part of the accountability system. So I don't have a good answer for you. I would acknowledge that it is a big challenge, and I think Mr. Saxon could talk a little bit about what they do to increase the quality of the data to contribute to that. So the cohort graduation rate is an improved graduation rate. It's much more precise and accurate than our previous graduation rates. It was initially adopted by the governors of the nation as part of the National Governors Association with an intent to create a rate that is more comparable among each of the states participating in the compact. It was subsequently adopted by the U.S. Department of Education as part of the No Child Left Behind Act and the Title I requirements to describe the percent of students that have graduated with a regular high school diploma. And the goal is to create a rate that is comparable among every state and that answers the following question: what percent of students who enter high school leave with a regular diploma? Which is a very specific question. And there are many other important questions about what happens in high school and what happens to kids before, during, and after high school. The cohort graduation rate does not describe all of those events and all of those important elements of high school, which it can be a public relations challenge. Human beings are much more complex than a single number. Schools are collections of human beings. So when we're talking about the percent of students who have graduated with a regular high school diploma in 4 or 5 years, we're talking about a relatively narrow outcome. But it is an outcome that is comparable, and it is an important benchmark for which we need to strive. So when we're talking about students who contribute to the graduation rate, we're talking about students who complete high school, and there's a couple of many different ways that students can complete high school. One of which is the one that we're all most invested in, is those students leaving with a regular diploma. And for the purposes of the cohort graduation rate, we would call those graduates. That's a relatively simple one. But the state legislature has adopted additional diplomas. We have the modified and the extended diplomas, as well as the alternative certificates. According to the Title I regulations of the U.S. Department of Education, those cannot be counted as graduates when we're talking about the 4-year graduation rate or the 5-year graduation rate. We would tend to talk about those as a completer rate if we were to choose to do so. But for the purpose of the cohort graduation rate, those students are not counted as graduates. In addition, students that receive GEDs and students that complete the 4 years of high school but don't receive the certificate of a diploma, those are also completers, but not necessarily students who but would not be counted as graduates for the purposes of the cohort graduation rate. So it gives you a sense of the narrow definition that we're talking about. When we're talking about dropout, those are students that are no longer engaged in high school, which is different than non-graduates. And this is a topic that's often really confusing to people. When we're talking about kids that drop out, those are kids that are no longer affiliated with any aspect of the educational system. So students that get GEDs, for instance, those are non-graduates, but they're not dropouts. Because
are those counted in the dropout rate, though? Like if you say 66% is our graduation rate, does that include these non-graduates?
It does. So dropouts, so when we're looking at non-graduates, non-graduates includes dropouts, students that don't graduate, and dropouts, those are students that completely disengage, or as Chair Haas noted, students that transfer out but their status is unknown. So those are students that we assume are dropouts unless told otherwise. Students who don't graduate in 4 years, and those are also counted as non-graduates until they graduate. Some of those students may eventually graduate in 5 years, and they would be counted as graduates in the 5-year cohort graduation rate. But for the purposes of the 4-year cohort graduation rate, even though they're still enrolled in school, they're considered non-graduates. And then there's students who don't get a diploma but stay in school. Those were also a form of non-graduate. So there's lots of different flavors of students lumped into that classification of non-graduate.
Can I ask a question, Senator Von Meacher? Thank you. When you talk about dropouts, is there a place, I don't want to go too far in advance, maybe you'll get to this, where you look at why a student dropped out?
Chair Haas and Senator Von Meacher, we do have some collection of data regarding why students drop out, but the quality of that data isn't particularly good because it really is subjective. Kids don't typically assert why they're dropping out before they drop out necessarily. So there is some subjective evaluation on part of schools as to what was the fundamental cause. And there's typically more than one reason. So identifying any single reason for what otherwise happened to a student over the course of 4 years leading to their lack of a diploma, it's hard to determine. But go ahead. Pat Burke, who's representing Portland State University, I think could talk at length about the research that's ongoing in Oregon and in the nation about the causes for dropout. So I would defer to him and to the superintendent on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Von Meacher, I think you could also hear from the superintendent of Tiger-Tualatin, and one of the reasons we hear a very prominent reason why students drop out is because once they start getting behind in their credits, if they get too far behind, they give up, and they feel that feeling of hopelessness that they could never catch up, and they just sort of give up unless there is a very strong intervention or a system where you can identify when kids are starting to get behind, and you have a system in place that identifies those students, and then you have a plan for how you're going to intervene with those students. So I think I'm really happy that Tiger-Tualatin is here, because that is exactly what they do to try to keep kids on track and to not have them fall behind and feel that feeling of that they can't be successful in school.
Thank you.
So the new cohort rate, as we mentioned, is a more precise rate. The old version of the graduation rate we label as the National Center for Educational Statistics rate, which is the NCS rate, and it is typically higher than the cohort rate. And the reason for that is that the number of graduates doesn't really change, although it's slightly restricted because we're talking about kids that graduate in 4 years, and the NCS rate doesn't have a limit on the number of years. But it really comes down to the count of kids who are eligible. And the NCS rate isn't reduced by a couple of factors, unlike the new rate. So the new rate tracks all students who enter high school and determines whether or not they left high school with a regular high school diploma, as I mentioned earlier. But in contrast to the old rate, the NCS rate, modified diplomas reduce the graduation rate because they're counted as a non-regular diploma graduate. And GEDs also reduce the graduate rate. Finally, students who graduate in more than 5 years reduce the four-year graduation rate, even though they may be counted as a graduate in a five-year cohort graduation rate. So that change we're still adjusting to as part of as a state process. It's hard to communicate effectively that it's not that fewer students are graduating than they have before. It's that we've changed the method by which we're calculating how many or what percent of students have graduated. So some things that are similar between the old rate and the new rate is that a regular high school diploma still counts as graduates, as it always did. And schools are held harmless, as we mentioned earlier, when students leave an Oregon public high school and enroll in a private school, leave for homeschooling, or transfer to a school in another state or country. The power of our data system is we have matched, we've joined the calculation of the graduation rate with the actual data that's submitted as part of the state school funding mechanism. So our average daily membership rate, average daily membership collection, which identifies every student that was enrolled in an Oregon public school, schools and districts tell us how those students left school. So if students are admitted, then districts don't receive funding for those students. So it's a nice validation and integration of the accountability system to ensure all students are tracked. For accountability purposes, we are low right now. Too few students are graduating with a regular high school diploma. Our targets for accountability starting out are for the four-year rate, we expect that 65% of students will graduate in 4 years, and 70% of students will graduate in 5 years. The targets go up just about every year now, and next year's targets go up to 67% and 72%. And we ramped up, we created a progression through 2020-21 where we expect that by then students will graduate, 90% of all students will graduate in 4 years and 5 years respectively with a regular high school diploma. And it's going to take a lot of effort in all parts of the system, the Department of Education, the legislature, and most importantly, schools and districts as they work with students to help them be successful. This is highlights what you already heard this morning, just a few minutes ago, about the rate. It's about 66% for all students at the four-year rate, 69% on the five-year rate, and then it's substantially lower in many of the subgroups, which is a key area of concern, and it's something that we monitor closely. I think that's the end of our presentation. We're available for questions.
Thank you. That's an excellent overview on how you get to these numbers. The old graduation rates aren't the new graduation rates.
Yeah, and that I think it's exciting that we do have data now that where we can do a better job of tracking every single student, and that's going to be really important for us as and for our schools to have that data so they can make better decisions about their kids and create better interventions to help them be successful.
Questions or comments? Mr. Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for being late. I had other obligations, so I'm probably guessing I'm maybe asking questions that have already been dealt with, but when we set these goals, how does that translate to the local districts with a degree of accountability for those districts? Because the department, you can set the goal and you can help in the measurements, but you can't really effectuate meaningful changes. How do you hold that accountability for districts in the family?
Chair Haas and Senator Morse, it's an excellent question. And so the department tries to do is we try and use the state regulations and federal regulations to create a meaningful system, as meaningful as we can, and work with districts to make it as effective as possible and give them valuable information to the extent that it is able to help them make good local decisions. But there is consequences when in the system if they don't meet these targets. So districts need to meet the graduation rate in order to meet, high schools and districts need to meet the graduation rate in order to meet adequate yearly progress targets. If they don't meet those targets for two or more years, there's incremental consequences. But what we're optimistic about is that more and more districts are taking up the mantle of addressing the rate based on the values and principles of helping all kids succeed. So we're hopeful that those consequences are a last resort and that hopefully they're not necessary.
Other questions? Well, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. So now that we know how this new methodology works, we can get to Senator Bonamici's question as to why the rates are where they are. And why don't I bring up together Patrick Burke and Rob Saxman.
Excuse me, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to be with you today. I'm Pat Burke. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Education, Leadership, and Policy at Portland State University. I'd like to share with you, it's going to sound a little bit like Tony and I planned this. I assure you we didn't, but actually where I start is actually right where Tony left off. So I think you'll see the connection. I think a basic question is why should we care about this? And in addition to all of the reasons that I think immediately come to mind, like it's the right thing to do for kids and kids deserve the best education that we can provide them. There's also an economic impact on the state, and I prefer to look at this from a glass half full. By cutting the dropout rate, we can actually create jobs and improve the financial health of the state. This is a report that was released just in late April. There's an organization and a national effort called the Talent Dividend that calculates the financial impact on communities of having students complete either a two-year or a four-year degree. So just an intriguing number, that calculation in the metropolitan statistical area, so it would be basically Portland and Beaverton, that increasing the college graduation rate by 1% over the next 4 years would have a $1.6 billion annual positive economic impact in the statistical area. So there are economic reasons why we would pay attention to these numbers. As Tony just described, these numbers represent a significant improvement, and I think the Department of Education deserves a lot of credit for doing this. Obviously, these numbers don't work unless you started collecting these data 5 and 6 years ago. That's the only way you can begin to calculate 4 and 5 year graduation rates. So there's a lot of background work that has been done. And as Tony pointed out, if you are a student of color, either African American or Latino, you are almost twice as likely not to graduate from high school on time. The same pattern is true in the dropout rate, where African American students in the 1 year dropout rate, as Tony explained, about 6.2% in the most recent data. That's a 1 year rate. Compared to a 3.4 statewide average. So there are significant issues in terms of race, social class, poverty, limited English proficiency, and who's completing high school in Oregon and who is not. So the question that Senator Bonamici raised was, so why are students leaving? So I did look at the data. Tony is correct that the data that is collected is not the greatest data, but it is what we have. And it's contained in something called the completers survey data. And what I've listed here are the reasons in rank order that are given, factors that influence students. And data are collected on student issues, family issues, school issues, and work factors. So as Superintendent Castillo pointed out, the highest, most frequently used reason is that students are too far behind in their credits to catch up. And what I'd like to point out is if that's the most frequently used reason, there's a historical context of that, which means that in years prior to the student leaving, there was a pattern of students not achieving credit at an appropriate rate. Poor home life and a lack of support for the student, working more than 15 hours a week, pregnancy, substance abuse, too many discipline referrals, and homeless students are the reasons in rank order. So looking at this, falling behind in credit and going to work are two things that students fall into this trap. It's basically what the research calls is a defeated learner. The student reaches a point where they say completing high school is just beyond what I'm willing to invest, and they leave and go to work. That is exacerbated somewhat in the current economy in that those types of jobs for low-skilled workers are harder to find. So how does Oregon compare to other places in the United States? Now, these data that come from a report called Building a Grad Nation are actually using that older method that Tony talked about, the National Center for Education Statistics method. So the numbers are a little higher. Oregon's graduation rate between 2002 and 2008 actually increased 5.7 percentage points on that measure. The number of what they define as low graduation rate high schools, and those are high schools where 40% of the senior class, is 40% smaller than the freshman class 3 years earlier. That's a tricky definition, but it's called a low graduation rate high school. Oregon had 7 of those schools in 2002, and in 2009 it had only 3, and only one of those was in an urban area. The other 2 are more rural. And the Oregon graduation rate, just compared to our neighbors, was slightly better than California and Washington, and slightly worse than Montana and Idaho. So Oregon was roughly sort of in the middle of the western states. Second question then is, of the students who are graduating, are they college ready? And this is an important question, especially with some policy changes that are coming at the federal level. So one way of looking at that, this is also tricky to define, but the ACT company does do, I think, a reasonable calculation of what college ready means. What they do is they take students who have participated in the early examination and they look at their scores and then follow those students into their first year of college and through research look at what level of performance on the ACT exam corresponds to successful completion of freshman college courses at the college level. And so what you see are the cut scores that their research indicates, 18 in English, 22 in reading, 22 in math, 22 in reading, and 24 in science. So how do Oregon students do? The black figures are the national figures. The orange figures are Oregon figures. And as you can see, we are, on this comparison, either at or slightly above the national average in terms of students meeting those benchmarks. Again, it's somewhat disturbing that we are lower in algebra and biology, that is, in the STEM areas, and higher in English, computation, and social sciences. However, when you disaggregate these numbers by race, a different story emerges. What we see is that Caucasian students and Asian students are far more likely in English composition to achieve that score than African American, Native American, or Hispanic high school graduates. The same is true in the social sciences. However, if you look at algebra and biology, a fairly alarming picture to me emerges in that in biology, for example, African American students are in single digits in reaching this score, and even for Caucasian and Asian American students, it's only 38% and 34% hitting those benchmarks. So a critical issue is not only are our students graduating, but are they graduating fully prepared to take their next steps as they move on in their education. I have some similar information on the SAT exam. About the average score for Oregon is in the mid-500s. That score has been that way. The bottom line, the total score, about 18,000 students taking this exam last year with a 523 reading score and a 524 math score. That's been about where Oregon has been for the last 4 or 5 years, right in that mid-520 range. But again, particularly looking at the mathematics area, you can see a significant gap between Caucasian scores, Asian scores, and students of color in the state. So in that environment, we now are looking at a very significant changing policy landscape. The first is the change in the Oregon diploma. And the change in the Oregon diploma is, I think, moving the state in the appropriate direction, increasing expectations for math and science, for example, establishing a floor in their mathematics program of Algebra 1. So what this does is it has the effect of raising the academic expectations for every student who comes through an Oregon high school. We require evidence of proficiency in essential skills. So regardless of the course that a student took, they are required to demonstrate proficiency. We have specified that science include scientific inquiry, and at least 2 of the 3 units in science have some laboratory experience. Education is more personalized in the state, and we have moved significantly toward being able to offer credit through demonstrated proficiency. Second key change in the policy landscape was the governor's executive order and Senate Bill 909 and moving toward a more integrated K-12 and higher education system. This is a significant change in looking at the outcomes of these systems taken collectively and not as discrete parts. That's a very significant change. Secondly, the idea that your committee has already discussed is that the outcome of the educational system may be driven by proficiency and can be more fluid between particularly high schools and colleges in terms of demonstrated proficiency. The idea of moving all kids to a higher standard and meeting the 40-40-20 goals of a rigorous diploma with the majority of students being well prepared for some post-secondary experience. The third, and I think one of the most important changing policy issues, is the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that is currently before Congress. It's contained in the overall structure is contained in the document, a blueprint for reform. It significantly changes the expectation outcomes at the federal level. We have, for the last 12 years now, been dealing with expectations around grade-level benchmarks in No Child Left Behind. The law requires the state to establish grade-level benchmarks, and the entire accountability system is based on whether or not each of those grade levels reach that benchmark. What we see happening at the federal level is a shift away from discrete grade-level benchmarks and looking at growth over time, more focused toward college readiness, and an expectation that all students would be prepared to move to more advanced education. A shift toward national common core standards and the development of national assessments. And new assessment systems would have the capacity to look at growth over time. I think we're very fortunate in Oregon that the Department of Education has already instituted growth model methodology in Oregon schools, and that information is already being reported. Teacher and administrator evaluations, including evidence of student growth, is part of that policy shift, and rewarding excellence and aggressively intervening schools that are not demonstrating improvement, and creating a culture for all students of some post-secondary readiness. So what does all this mean? Priority is being given to state-developed and adopted common college and career-ready standards. You may remember part of the Race to the Top grants that 48 states actually applied for. It was a requirement that they sign on to the national core standards that are being promulgated. There's much more emphasis on system integration. So more and more we're seeing that the thinking is not high school ending as a discrete point and something new beginning at college, but a continuation of a system across a pre-K-20 continuum. Academically rigorous coursework being expected of every student, and accountability being based on continuous and appropriate rates of student growth, especially those demonstrated between schools, districts, and, interestingly enough, in this in these new federal policies, institutions of higher ed now being held accountable for demonstration of student growth and progress. So how would we respond? First of all, I think if I would say anything today to this committee, low graduation rates are a system problem. They are not a high school problem. And if we continue to treat this just as a high school issue and not look at the longitudinal system, we're really going to miss an opportunity to make significant improvements in the system. Secondly, I think we have to look at early literacy. One of the key stumbling blocks for high school students not completing is an inability to read complex material. So I'm not talking about just being able to read a book, but I'm talking about early literacy that moves along a continuum that prepares students to deal with complex content when they get to the secondary level. There's a critical importance of looking at middle school practice in making sure that students exit middle school fully prepared. We're seeing many districts in the state looking at summer transition programs, ninth grade counts, and other types of activity that prepare students for moving forward. And finally, the attainment of rigorous content is expected of all kids in a system, not just some kids in a system. So we've seen, for example, many of our high schools begin to broaden participation in things like advanced placement courses and opening up those types of opportunities for students. So there are many promising practices that we see. Proficiency-based instruction, so students are able to demonstrate their proficiency and can move through a system with more flexibility without necessarily being restricted to just seat time. We're seeing more use of dual credit and other ways for students to get early college access, so that we're seeing more and more students exiting high school with college credit already under their belt. We're seeing more opportunities for applied learning, where students actually have an opportunity to engage in the field and use the skills that they have been studying. That might be the second thing that I would place the highest priority on, is you can't underestimate the importance of early intervention around attendance and credit accrual. There's been some significant research out of California where the state of California invested significant dollars, millions of dollars, in credit retrieval programs at the end of the senior year to help kids graduate. Turned out to be a colossal failure because the opportunity to pull kids back at that point and to add on to their credits is not nearly as effective as early investment early on in the life of the student to make more appropriate progress. And then finally, integrating systems of student support, smaller environments, and interagency collaboration. It may be abundantly obvious to people, but I think we have to recognize that schools will not alone be able to have the level of student support that may be needed to address some of the issues that I pointed out earlier in terms of student lives, but through collaboration and working with different agencies working together, we can do that. So what do we need to do that? What kinds of tools would we be looking for? And you already have seen evidence from what Tony was describing. You need a really good data system. You need robust data systems that integrate across grade levels and into higher ed. We still in the state we're closer than we were, but we still do not have a system that follows students out of an Oregon high school into either a community college or a four-year institution. We're getting there, but we're still not there yet. We need better early warning systems around grades, attendance, and credit accrual, as I mentioned before. We need clear and more meaningful school and district accountability measures. At the high school level, for example, under No Child Left Behind, you have one grade level, two tests, and that's the extent of federal accountability at the high school level. 10th grade assessment this year moving to the 11th grade assessment in reading and writing. We need a more robust measure and a more accurate measure, and that needs to link across all levels of the enterprise. Secondly, I would recommend looking at clear and high expectations and standards. What I mean by that is course alignment for readiness and transition to the next level. This is not as easy to do as just saying it. What we find is that teachers still, in some cases, operate in isolation from each other. One course does not necessarily automatically feed into the next course. If you think of an appropriate math sequence, for example, how do we align that that instructional program? Early and more meaningful intervention around chronic absenteeism, especially at the middle level. Research is fairly clear that chronic absenteeism is a strong predictor of future dropping out behavior. If we intervene earlier, we can head some of that off. We need to clarify this notion of college and career ready. What does that look like in our classes? What proficiencies actually, and I'm not necessarily even talking about high school. How would you know, for example, that a 6th grade, 7th grade math program was on an appropriate trajectory to prepare a student for college readiness at the end of high school? That takes a lot of work to look at that type of alignment and to continue to try to engage parents and communities in more significant interaction. We need to focus on teaching and learning, particularly how we prepare teachers, continuous high-quality professional development. Your committee this session has already looked at several bills on this particular topic. I strongly applaud that and encourage you to keep looking at how we can build in that continuous professional development for teachers. Meaningful support for students. This particularly in the way of career pathways that are integrated with post-secondary connections. I hear this from my university colleagues very, very often, particularly at a place like Portland State, where we have a lot of first-generation students. We have students who come to us who do not really have a background in their family about how to negotiate the college environment. So better pathways that are clear and better articulated. Multiple opportunities to stay connected with kids. What I mean by that is that if a student is disconnecting from the school, we have ways, online courses, night school, summer programs, other ways to keep an organizational connection with the student. And community engagement and collaboration with community-based organizations, I mentioned that earlier, as a way of broadening our reach. And finally, and I couldn't pass an opportunity to say this, we need better research. We need to be able to ask these kinds of critical questions of the instructional program and how we connect better to diverse populations. So I'd like to end by at least sharing with you quickly one promising strategy that we're engaged in Multnomah County. It's called a Cradle to Career Initiative. And what it does is it looks at the system in its collective from the time a child is born, and in the case of our data, actually prenatally, through when a student completes post-secondary education and enters the workforce, and divides that along a data trajectory or a data framework that is based on research that looks at key leverage points or indicators that would tell you whether or not the system is delivering what it needs to do. And it would have both academic and social and community indicators and a backbone organization or a way to organize that work. Our project is part of the Strive National Partnership, and the program at Portland State is one of five national demonstration sites. What you see are the other sites, university city partnerships that are involved in this around the country. On your website is a copy of this document, and I've given a couple of copies to the committee. This is a data framework around this trajectory. Across the top, you see five strategic goals: students entering school prepared to learn, students being supported inside and outside of school, students succeeding academically, students enrolling in post-secondary education, and students completing post-secondary education. As you may know, our completion rates in post-secondary are not very good in the state of Oregon right now, so it's a critical data indicator. And then looking at academic and social indicators that are then used to put together planning teams along that continuum to collectively talk about how can we improve the indicator, how do we move the needle forward. This gives you an idea of some of the data points that are contained in the report. And this is a report that would be released on a regular basis and serve as a report card. And it provides an opportunity to look along a continuum from birth through post-secondary education and identify key strategies that the research would indicate would improve those overall outcomes. This has proven to be a way for all of the districts in Multnomah County, city and county government, private nonprofit corporations, businesses, and community-based organizations to come together. There is now an advisory council, a data team, a steering committee, and the formation is now underway of these what are called Student Success Network teams being put together. This is happening across the country and seems to be an exciting approach to system integration and the use of longitudinal data. So thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to answer questions when you have
them. Well, thank you. That was a good presentation. I know that we do have some questions, but why don't we go to Superintendent Saxton first, and we'll ask you both some questions. Superintendent Saxton is here because his school district, counterintuitively in some ways, has one of the highest graduation rates in the state. So we asked him to join us.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hess, and members of the committee, and for the opportunity to talk to you today. Well, first of all, I gave you a couple DVDs, so they're not going to be in my office anymore, but one of them is Response to Intervention, a Multi-Tiered Instructional Approach around Elementary, and the other one is around Secondary, so there are two parts to that. And if you are interested in anything that I have to share today, it might be an opportunity for you to see what that looks like in action. And I also would invite any of you to come by any of our schools anytime. I'd love to have you shown around and have an opportunity to see some of the things that are happening in Tiger-Tualatin. It's it's a little bit awkward to come and talk about a four-year cohort graduation rate. I think that Tiger Twalton has had some notice recently for the four-year cohort rate that we were able to achieve, that our students were able to achieve, and yet our rate was 80.1%, or about 80.86, 81%. And I think we get some notice there because our demographics, as when we compare our four-year cohort rate to school districts with similar demographics, we far exceed their four-year cohort rate, and we certainly exceed the state's rate of about 66%, so we're about 15% ahead of that. And so some people have asked, what is it that's happening in the Tiger Tualatin School District that would cause that to happen? I guess what I would tell you is that, you know, anytime we're not at 100%, I think we have some work to do. And so our district certainly has some work to do. We need to do a better job of making sure that all of our students graduate, and we're not there yet. But I do think that we can continue to improve. I think, first of all, it's important for people to know that a dropout rate isn't a reflection on any single person or program, but really the efforts of a whole system. And that system is the entire school community. So it's our parents, it's our town, it's our schools, our educators, teachers, classified, and administrative staff, kindergarten through grade 12. And it is an opportunity for me to say to the people in the community of Tiger Tualatin and the folks who work in our schools, congratulations for the good job that they've done. And be prepared, because we're going to need to continue doing the work at a much harder and faster rate. Our mission in Tiger Tualatin is educate every child, and we work hard at that. I think probably the long and the short of what I'm going to say today is that we need to teach really hard, and we need to do it really smart. And that kind of is what I'm going to talk about. In Tiger Tualatin, we have found that whenever we take an intentional action for improvement, if we identify something that we need to improve on and we take intentional, thoughtful action about it, that we are able to make a difference in the kind of student outcomes that we get. But we have to be really intentional and focused on the work that we're going to do. And so first and foremost, we have to find the best evidence-based practices that exist. And when I say evidence-based practice, a research-based practice is something that's been proven to work in a research project. Evidence-based is something that's happened out in the real world and is repeatable in other places. So, and then there's evidence collected around that that it's working. And so we look for evidence-based best practices in Tiger Tualatin. We're trying to figure out how we're going to positively impact something that's happening around what we're doing and our student outcomes. I'm going to start probably in a different place. I appreciate that Pat said we're not talking about a high school issue. We're talking about a systemic issue. And so I'm really going to start by talking about kindergarten, because that really is where this all happens. I was interested in the thought that by 2021 that we would want to have 90% of the students in the state of Oregon graduate with a four-year cohort rate, so 90% success, because those students are currently in first grade. And the clock is ticking on those kids. And really and truly, the clock started last year when they were in kindergarten and when they should have had full-day kindergarten. Because we have an issue there where in
the back.
Yeah. when we take a look at what happens there, if we don't have a student be a reader by the end of second grade, it is going to be nearly impossible for them to be a reader. Now, we're going to work at it like crazy, but it's going to be very difficult to get there. And when you just look at the time that kids have to have an opportunity to learn between kindergarten start and the end of second grade, and you take half of that away in the first grade, and then you calculate in what's actual instructional time versus time that's not instructional, there's about a 28% increase in just raw instructional time that occurs if you have full-day kindergarten versus when you don't have full-day kindergarten. And again, if we don't have a student ready to read by the end of second grade, we're just going to be chasing our tail in many ways, and it's a pay for it then or pay for it later when it comes to full-day kindergarten. In our district, we employ what we call EBIS, or Effective Behavior and Instructional Supports, and I don't know if people have talked about that in front of this committee before, but it is a system that goes through our entire program, K through 12. And we are a demonstration site for that. We have people come from all over the state, the Northwest, and the nation, and really even other countries. Yesterday we had people from the state of Oregon, four different states, and Guam visiting in our schools, our demonstration site schools, to take a look at what we do with EBIS and another thing that we call RTI, or Response to Intervention, which is what these videos are kind of those two things in combination. Which really, EBIS is two different things. The EB is Effective Behavior. behavior. And it really is our premise in the district that we can't expect students to know what we don't teach them. And so when we have students come in at the beginning of the school year and at the beginning of their program in Tiger Tualatin, we are very specific about what we expect from them when it comes to behavior. And we actually teach in a systemic and specific way about what it is that we expect for students around behavior. And we do that all the way through our system, K through 12. And what we do there, again, is very specific, and it makes a really big difference. The IS part is instructional support. And what we really find is that there's a combination between student misbehavior and their ability to be successful in school. And specifically, there's even a closer tie between student misbehavior and their ability to read. Because when a student can't read, and they're going to be put on the spot to read, they've got to find a way to get out of class. Or any other myriad of things. They can't turn their homework in. There's 100 different things that come when a student is unable to read. And so those two things get tied together. And so because we've taught students how we expect them to behave and we track with data systems what kind of behaviors we get, we're able to start to put together a pattern of student misbehavior that may indicate something besides, I'm just not a very good kid. And some of that has to do with their ability to read, and those two things get tied together. Our system, when it comes to the instructional support, starts with an assessment in the reading skill of every student within the first few days of their arrival in the school district, and that includes kindergarten. And so we have a different set of assessments depending on age-appropriate level, but we're going to assess kids as soon as they arrive at our schools, and it will help us identify learning needs of each student and be able to intervene in an intense way so that we can work to make sure that we get every student a reader as quickly as we possibly can. Because, again, we really have what I would call a hair-on-fire emergency when somebody shows up in kindergarten to make sure that they're going to be a reader by the time that they're into the second grade. And they will never, never, in the rest of their career, have the same learning experience if they can't read by the end of second grade as their typical peers. Because from that point forward, we're going to be taking them out of class or having them stay after school or be in summer school or all three of those things as we work on being intentional about trying to help them recover the reading that they don't have, while all their other peers are going to be experiencing other kinds of learning opportunities back in their home classroom. Or they're going to be in their home classroom with the inability to read and they can't access content material. Because after second grade, the expectation is that you're going to be able to read in order to access content. And if I can't do that, or I'm being pulled out so that I can work on my reading, I can't have the same educational experience as my typical peers. And really and truly, their life experience after that is forever changed. Because it makes it difficult then to get the same education as everyone else. We live in the information age. And the information age is about accessing information, and you do that through reading. And not being able to is akin, really, to not being able to work with stone in the Stone Age. You cannot provide for yourself. You cannot provide for your family. And that really and truly, it is that kind of an emergency, when I say hair on fire emergency, to make sure that we have every kid be a reader by the end of second grade. So we identify students through that assessment system, K through 2, and anytime they show up in our school in any grade. And if we identify that they're struggling to read, we implement a series of specific and intensive interventions. And when I say interventions, what we need to understand is what's causing them the difficulty with their reading. And then we need to have the appropriate intervention around that challenge. So it could be that they don't have good phonemic awareness. They can't sound out letters and therefore words. It might be that they don't have good comprehension. They don't understand what it is that they're decoding. Or it could be a problem with vocabulary. Or it could be a problem with the speed at which they read that causes all of that. And so we intervene with a really specific intervention in order that's targeted to get at what that student's issue is. And it is intensive. So we're going to go either one-on-one or in small group, and we're going to spend increased time working with those students on reading. So every student in our school district, grades K through 5, gets 90 minutes of reading instruction every day. And if I have a reading issue, I will get another 60 to 90 minutes of reading instruction. And so when I talk about not being with my typical peers, I'm serious about that. And that intervention is going to be specific about that student's reading issue, and we will have identified what that is through an assessment. And so it's going to be very intense. Typically, then we'll work with a student for a period of time and then measure how that intervention is working. And if it's working, we'll continue with it until they're reading like their typical peers. If it isn't working, then we would switch to a different curricular and or intervention system with the same level of intensity, or perhaps even an increased level of intensity, so around time or smaller group work, and then see how they respond to that intervention. And part of the reason that we do that, and we'll do that somewhere between 2 and 4 different times, is because if a student doesn't start to respond to that and doesn't start to become a reader, then we start thinking about whether or not they have some kind of a learning disability. And all that work already leads us into a process that would have us identify them as eligible for special education, which wouldn't change what we're doing around reading intervention and work with them to be a reader, but it might change what we do with some other parts of their program. And that is what we call response to intervention. And right now the Tiger Tualatin School District has a contract through the Oregon Department of Education to be the district that goes out across the state and trains other school districts in response to intervention, which would be kind of the whole system that I just talked about and tried to identify. And so we're out there doing that. At the end of this year, we will have trained 40 other school districts in this methodology, and many of those school districts are starting to get really impressive results, and we're excited about that, and we'll hopefully train another cohort of districts next year and on into the future. So again, we would then start to identify the student as potential for special education. I will tell you that in Tiger Tualatin, typically we under-identify as compared to the 11% special education that the state allows school districts to receive extra funding for. I don't know what the state average is in special ed identification. I know it's 13% or thereabouts, but we're typically under 11%. That really has a huge impact on the resources that we spend in the district, and it has a big impact on the resources that are available for other districts across the state. But more importantly than anything, we have students who have showed up in our school that are underprepared to be successful. That in many districts, because they come underprepared, would be identified as eligible for special education services because they can't be learners. And we are intensive with them about reading. We get them to be readers, and they're never identified for special education because they're able then to be successful as a reader and then access other content material throughout the course of their educational career. And that is a really big systemic difference, and it makes a difference in some of the kinds of things that we were talking about when it comes to dropout rate, because if I've been identified as a substandard learner, it's really difficult for me to get excited about and be successful in school. And if I can't read, again, it becomes even more difficult every day as we go along. But if I become a reader, or even if I am identified as special ed, I'm getting help that causes me to be able to access content, it makes me more likely to graduate. And so those are some of the things that we're working on. I will tell you that if a child doesn't become an effective reader as they move through our program, we don't stop. We're going to continue to intervene all the way through the day that they graduate. There are some people who do things really well, very naturally. My sister can play the piano like you cannot believe. My mom was a piano teacher. She worked with me forever, and I can play, but only if I practice hour after hour after hour, and I might, you know, be one-tenth of my sister who might not play for several years. And it's the same thing with reading. But it's so important, you have to continue with that instruction if you're going to have somebody be successful at that. So they need the constant practice on the piano. There are other things that we have in place in our district. It was really interesting. I wanted to bring back up the slide that said how do we respond, because I think I could sort of almost tick off the things that were the how to respond slide, and you don't need to. But it just was like every single bullet point that was on there is something that we do. So we do, in our secondary schools, we do have summer school program for both our 6th graders and our 9th graders as they move through transition. One of our big goals with our underperforming 8th graders is to get them into summer school and make sure they earn a high school credit before they ever show up in the 9th grade. And we find that if a student can earn 6 credits as a freshman, they're much more likely to graduate, and if they don't, they're not. And so getting that one credit prior to them getting there and having a lot of that credit be about how to be successful in high school is really an important opportunity. All of our students are currently on track to be algebra or higher by the 8th grade in the Tiger Tualatin School District. That would be the normal track. It is the exact same algebra course as we offer in the high school, and we give an end-of-year assessment to all students so that, who take algebra in our district so that we can measure the outcomes that we have for any student in the system that takes it, whether they're an 8th grader, a 7th grader, or an 11th grader. And so I know that sometimes people think when you have 8th grade algebra that you're watering down the algebra. We're not, and our outcomes would show that we're not. And that is really important when it comes to students being successful. We do give the ACT battery assessment all the way through 11th grade for all of our students, and it really helps students who perform well on that understand what they understand that they have an opportunity to be successful in college, and helps them start thinking about next steps. We also use the assessment battery that comes with that to identify some career opportunities for kids and do their career profile, and it helps us identify what classes students should take as they move through school, and students to identify that for themselves. We have a Community Experience in Career Education Partnership, CE2 program, and that program is an opportunity for students to do some learning in school and then out in the community and job experiences, which is a really rich experience and a very successful, one of the oldest career opportunity classes in the nation, or programs in the nation. We do have an alternative program. The Durham Center Alternative Education Program offers a wide variety of alternative programs for students who need school a little bit differently, including some small group work, some packet work, some online instruction, some online recovery opportunities. We do I think a very nice job in the district with some wraparound services around social services, whether it comes to clothing. We have a school-based health center for all students, mental health access, drug and alcohol counseling. And one of the biggest things in our district and a key initiative for us right now is our really deep commitment to closing the racially predictable achievement gap and equity and the work that we're doing. We're in our fifth year of a really detailed system around this work. And I will tell you that right now the Tiger Tualatin is 37% students of color, and that increases by 3% a year, which means that in 4 years we'll be more than 50% students of color in Tiger Tualatin. And if we cannot figure out how to close the racially predictable achievement gap, and you saw the data up here for our college readiness, especially in science and math, for our Hispanic and African American students, we will not be successful as a state. It is the second hair on fire emergency that we have. And we are working at that as fast and as furious as we can in our school district. I will say that we have assistant principals at the high school that just don't let kids fail. They're going to go out and hunt them down and drag them back, kicking and screaming, and make sure that they're successful no matter what happens. And lastly, looking into the future, we need to ensure that we continue to have at least this level of success with our students. And right now, the students in the class of 2012 and beyond must demonstrate proficiency in reading by passing the Oaks Readings Assessment or other measures in order to graduate. And currently, over 90% of our junior class, which is the class of 2012, has demonstrated that ability by passing the Oaks Assessment or some other measure, but primarily Oaks. Students in the class of 2000, I do believe that by the end of 2012, when those kids are seniors next year, 95% of our students will have met that requirement, and so 95 will be able to graduate based on the Oaks proficiency. And in 2013-14, we start with proficiency in writing, and then math in 2014 are required to earn the Oregon Diploma, and we intend to have similar results. So that's a lot, and probably sounds... I'm not sure what, but it's a lot of work that's going on, and the good people in Tiger Tualatin and the hardworking students there are making that happen. So,
Rob, questions. Thank you. It sounds good, and we appreciate you imparting your wisdom to other school districts or whatever winning formula you've put together. I get two things out of that: reading and full day kindergarten.
Reading, full day kindergarten, close the racially predictable achievement gap.
Questions for either one of our esteemed panelists? Senator Morris?
Thank you. Very encouraging to hear what you're doing.
Thank you.
We passed a bill from the Senate to the House that set a date certain for full-day kindergarten. It's kind of in a little high center over there. What would be your thoughts and recommendations? I'm putting you on the spot.
Senator Hass, Senator Morris, it's with a great deal of pride that I tell you that Karen Twain, who chaired the committee on full-day kindergarten is a principal of ours and has been at Metzger Elementary, where we implemented full-day kindergarten and just did an unbelievable job, and is now in charge of the Durham Education Center that I talked about, our alternative programs, and is doing a terrific job for us there. You know, I think around full-day K, obviously, the concern is about it being an unfunded mandate. And I have lots of comments about why I think that we should go ahead and that I wish that bill would pass and that we would have full-day kindergarten for all students beginning in 2015. And I know that you've heard those through that committee, and I have been down and talked to everybody who will let me through their door about that particular bill on the House side, including the co-chairs of Rules and anybody else. And I know that there was a hearing on it yesterday, and that no action was taken. And I do plan to go see a couple people before I leave today, and I'm really hopeful that we'll get that done this time. And if we can't, we'll be back. It really is a pay now or pay later proposition, and the amount of money that we spend as a district in trying to recover students who aren't able to be a reader by the end of second grade is much more than it would be if we have full-day kindergarten across the board. And we do have the majority of our students in our district in full-day K. We need to get to a place where they all are, and we're just going to have to take that on ourselves. It's really hard for me to sit here and say we ought to do that across the state, and we haven't accomplished that completely in our district. But I can tell you that we are highly committed to having that happen within the next few years in Tiger-Tualatin, because we really wreck a great deal of carnage on people and their life experience when we don't provide them with that opportunity. It makes a huge difference, especially to our poor kids and our students of color.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator George?
That brings up an interesting issue. The what you guys are doing is innovative, and obviously I applaud you for taking this around, but in going through the statistics we were talking about, a lot of this is income-driven. And so lower the income, hence the less the parents are engaged in getting the kids to school. In every area of public policy, if somebody was doing this to society by not having their kids go to school, but an equivalent driving drunk on the roads, doing something dangerous with their business, we would go after the person who was putting that product or that activity out into the public. In this environment, there doesn't seem like there's any kind of investigation about what parents' roles are in this situation. And I appreciate the fact that almost every one of these programs was how the schools need to get better. We talk about that all the time. But at some point, if people are receiving public assistance, if people are receiving public benefit, and then they are then transferring a burden onto society, there has to be some kind of price. That may sound heartless, but at some point there's a huge social cost that stays with these kids forever. Is there any studies about programs where we withdraw public support for people if they don't do their responsibility of their kids?
Senator Hess, Senator George, let me approach that from the opposite end of the lens for just a second. There's actually more data on where that issue has been addressed and improvement is seen. I would cite, for example, Forest Grove High School. I don't know if you've had an opportunity just in this past year. Several parent organizations from Forest Grove have been presenting to other parent organizations about what happened at Forest Grove. Forest Grove, as you may know, has become one of the state's highest performing high schools, even though it's very high poverty and has a high Latino population. And one of the things that happened was local community organizers who approached the district and said, we will make sure that our students do what is expected of them if you tell us what that is. And what had happened was an assumption that parents automatically knew about things like test scores and grades and homework assignments and things like that. But when you were talking about a first-generation community of low-income, non-English speaking parents who had not finished school themselves, they had no idea of what was to be accomplished. So it started as a grassroots organization of people organizing small cells at the classroom level, small groups, 5-8 parents coming in, working with a translator, getting to know the teacher, having the teacher explain things like what amount of homework do I assign every day, what's the reading, what's the math, and so on. It actually improved the level of engagement, but it started at a very comfortable, very small level, and that became the base upon which more involvement was done. The Salem Coalition for Equality does similar work here in Salem in terms of it's old-fashioned community organizing in bringing parents into the process in giving them the skills to make a positive difference. Now, having said that, you are also correct that the consequences for things like truancy are pretty negligible, and also, when schools, principals, superintendents decide to take action, they incur quite a bit of cost in actually taking that through the courts. And the consequence as a result is also pretty minor. In many cases, a citation is issued notifying someone that they're not meeting their parental obligation to have the student in school. So that there is an area of improvement around what happens in cases of chronic absenteeism. We've lost a lot of our capacity to send staff out to homes to find out what's going on in cases of chronic absenteeism. We've got pretty good systems to know who's not coming to school, but we still have a difficult time of getting out into the neighborhood and finding out. But I've seen a lot of evidence around the state where not just assuming that people will come to school, you know, we'll hold a big parent meeting, we'll expect everybody to come, but very specifically reaching out to communities and inviting their participation actually has had some very positive payoff in many of our schools.
Senator Hess, Senator George, I don't know if you wanted me to respond as well, but I'll take a couple shots. One of them is that as an educator, I'm always really nervous whenever anybody wants me to let somebody else take responsibility for the education of their child. And so when we start talking about, you know, sort of who's responsible for what happens with the education that a student receives, there's a lot of things that we don't control as a school system. And we need to take responsibility for what we do control. And so when we talk about it, at least in Tiger Tualatin, we really try to talk about looking in the mirror and not, you know, looking elsewhere. What are we going to do? How are we going to do this? Because all that other stuff, how much a student, you know, where a student comes from, how much their parent makes, what their parent expectation is, those things we don't. What kind of parent engagement that we can get, we do. And so we're going to work really hard at those things. But we would like to take as much responsibility as we possibly can, because otherwise we're just making excuses, and we don't want to do that. The other thing we've really had a lot of conversation about in our district is the issue between poor and race. And that is a really difficult conversation to have, because whenever you bring race into a conversation, people get afraid, because most of us are kind of old white guys like me, and typically we say the wrong thing when we start talking about race, and it gets really scary to talk about it. So I can feel the sweat a little bit already as I'm sitting here, but we also have come to realization that it's a conversation that we have to have. And when I looked at the data that I saw up here about with the racial disaggregation, the thing that I thought was, I wish the other piece of that was up there right now was the disaggregation around parental income. Because what you'll find is when you take a look at like the SAT and the ACT assessments and you compare parental income and race, that the poorest white kids, parents who make less than $20,000 a year, still outperform the richest African Americans on the ACT and the SAT. And so then when you start trying to think about what causes the biggest difference when it comes to student learning, I would submit that it's race and not poverty. And that's not been a really easy thing for us to talk about, because race is such a difficult thing for us to talk about in this country. And when you start talking about the coexistence of race and poverty, It even gets more difficult to have a very coherent conversation about, and it really is sort of politically dangerous. And yet it is the case. We've looked at that data on a national basis, and we've looked at it in the Tiger Tualatin School District, and it is absolutely true that the poorest white kids outperform our most affluent African Americans and Hispanic kids. And so that's why we started having a conversation in our district about race and closing the racially predictable achievement gap. We have called in our parents of color in groups. In fact, we have a celebration that I need to get to tonight of over 150 of our parents of color as we've worked to try to create a relationship and engage them in the education of their children. But it really is a significant issue, and as I said, in our district, over 50% of our students are going to be students of color in 4 years. And we've got to figure out how to close that achievement gap. And I will tell you that because we've started to talk about it and we've begun to look at it and to be intentional, like I said when I started, when we get intentional about something, we're able to see results. Because we become intentional, we are seeing that we are able to close that achievement gap. And the data that we started to see over the last 2 years is really significant. And I believe that by the end of next year, we will have closed that gap by 50%.
Gentlemen, thank you. You filled us with encouragement, stuffed our brains with ideas. So.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Before we take off, without objection, or we need unanimous approval to go into a work session on House Bill 3298 for purposes of allowing Senator Morris to vote.
Does it require a rule suspension?
I think just requires no objections.
No objections. Okay.
So I'll go into a work session on House Bill 3298. Senator Morris, how do you vote?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote aye.
Vote is recorded. So ordered. We're going to close the work session on 3298. Thank all of you. That was very eye-opening. We are adjourned.